Well, you got to do it right. My name's Matthew. I have alcoholism. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's an honor. It's humbling to be here, and I want to thank everybody who is responsible for that. It's actually Larsine, if anybody knows Larsine. But I do want to say before I get into why Larsine hijacked me for this conference is I've been to a lot of these things, and this is the largest table I've ever seen up on the stage. And I feel like I'm at a wedding, and I'm going to make a toast to two dysfunctional families joining together, because I know all these people. Now, I was speaking at Gopher State Roundup last year, and Larsine said, you know, Bill's going to speak on Monday morning at the South Bay Roundup, and it's very important to all of us that Bill's going to do that. Bill is my best friend on the whole planet. He's been my sponsor for a long time, and we're just very, very close and love each other very much. And it's a very important thing that Bill's doing this, and he'll tell you why. And I said, yeah, I'm so excited about that. And Larsine said, are you going to come? And I said, well, I know I have that weekend free, but I'm traveling a lot. And then I got up and spoke at Gopher State Roundup. And then I came down, and Larsine said, isn't it great that you're going to be the Saturday night speaker at the South Bay Roundup? And I said, no, I don't think I am. And she goes, oh, yes, you are. So that's how I got here. Yeah. So thank you, Larsine, because it does mean a lot to me. And it's just very humbling. I mean, there are people in this room who I met my first day in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have never really had the opportunity to speak at a conference where that's true so prevalently. And also, I want to thank the people that have driven from different cities to come see me. It's good to see you, Matt and Laura and Michelle. Thank you for coming. And Dave, my sobriety date's May 16th, 1993. My home group, for all intents and purposes, will forever be the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag on Monday nights. Come on, guys. I live in Gig Harbor, Washington, so it's really hard to get there on Mondays. But, you know, when there's a will, there's a way. And the truth is, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel a great responsibility when I come up here to try to convey what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I also know, because I've tried to do this many, many times, that I am going to fail at that. Because it is absolutely impossible for me to tell you what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because 99% of it happened inside of me. So we're sort of stuck with the story, right? And I really prayed a lot this afternoon in my room that I would really spend a little bit of time on what it was like so that you'll trust that I have alcoholism. And spend the best of the time and the majority of the time about what the journey of recovery has been like, because I absolutely am passionate about recovery and the recovery program and all that it's done for me. So unfortunately, I just am stuck with the story. And I'll say that I always like to say that my parents were not alcoholics. My parents were really good examples of how to live life. My father worked very, very hard to support four children and put us all through college. He was an insurance salesman, which he did not want to be. He did that for us. He wanted to be an advertisement man. He was a boisterous, fun Irish guy. I loved being around my father. I could find my father in a crowd by his laugh. If I waited enough time, he would laugh, and I would find him. My mother was a school teacher. She was really sensitive and quiet. She was the opposite of my father. But my mother is responsible for a lot of the growth that I had in my life because she paid attention to who her son was, and she directed me in that way. And I'll give you some examples of that, I hope. But anyway, I came from a good family, and I'll tell you about my first drink, and hopefully I'll tell you about my last drink, and then I'll talk about recovery. My brothers, I have two brothers and a sister, and both my brothers are alcoholics, and my brother just above me, Neil, who's 6 or 7 years older than me, he was really, really a bad alcoholic when I was a kid. When I was 10 years old, he was already getting into a lot of trouble, and we kicked him out of the house eventually, which I couldn't believe we did. But as a result of that, I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to fight with my father and my mother. I love my father and my mother. I didn't want to cause all this heartache that I was watching in my family, so I didn't really drink. And then it was my junior or senior year of high school. I was with these guys, and I went to a small Catholic school. I went to St. James School. I went to Bishop Montgomery High School. And it's a pretty tight-knit group to go to Catholic school in the 70s in Redondo Beach. You have to remember that Ridgemont High, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, that was Redondo High. That's where Cameron Crowe went to write that script. And that was right across the street from my Catholic school. And when we used to walk to school in our uniforms, people from Redondo High would throw rocks at us. So we were persecuted Christians in the 70s. And we really didn't care that much about the religion. Our parents just sent us to this school. So it's very odd, but we were really close. And I had these five guys that were my best friends. There were six of us. And it's funny, I look back at this, and I always felt like they knew something I didn't know. I felt like they were better looking than me. I felt like they were better athletes than me. They were better athletes than me. I felt like they were smarter than me. And it's so funny that I thought that, because I look back on my life, and I was class president. I dated the head cheerleader all through high school. I played in a really ripping rock and roll band. But I just felt like everybody else had it going on, and I didn't. And my senior year of high school, these guys were together with a bottle of tequila at a house in Hermosa Beach on 10th Street in Monterey, where my good friend Casey lived. And he was from another large Irish Catholic family. He had eight brothers and sisters. And everybody was gone but these guys. And I didn't drink. And they were taking shots of tequila. And my brother at that time was homeless. And my family life was not good. My father was bipolar, but we didn't know that at the time. That became more vogue afterwards. And so there was a lot of weird dynamics at my house that I didn't understand. And when they were taking that tequila, I couldn't take it anymore. I was a really skinny guy. I had acne from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, or that's how I felt. And I just felt like I wasn't cool. And they were drinking tequila. And I said, hey, I'll take a shot of that. And they said, it's tequila. They might as well have said something in Chinese. I was like, oh, can I have a shot of that? And they were not the type of guys that pressured me to drink. They were just really good, kind people. And I took a shot of tequila, and only you people know what happened. It hit my chest, and it got so warm in my chest, and 12 years of Catholic school guilt melted out of my shoulders. And my acne went, and I thought, and I was funny and articulate, and I thought, if you give me a ball right now, I bet I could throw that goddamn thing, you know? And I liked it so much, I got a much bigger glass, and they reiterated the title of the drink to me, and I was like, I don't even care, just pour some more in there, and it was so great for like 25 minutes. And then I had to go to the bathroom. And this is a big house in Hermosa Beach with, you know, all these bedrooms because they had all these kids. And again, we're there all by ourselves. And I had a bedroom there because we all kept our surfboards there in the summer. So I'm walking down the hall, and suddenly I'm on a cruise ship. And I don't know why. And it's moving and it's rocking. And I thought, that's weird. This house was so stationary a couple of weeks ago. And I got down to the bathroom, and I went into the bathroom, and they had two sinks, which I thought meant you were wealthy, right? Because we didn't have two sinks at my house. And I sat down on the toilet, and the room started to spin. And you got to remember, I went to Catholic school, and I took it kind of seriously. It was the only religion I'd ever heard of. And the nuns were pretty serious about how they imparted it to us. And I remember my last thought before I passed out was that God would not make a body that could defecate and vomit at the same time. Because Sister Dennis Ann said God was perfect. And many people in this room probably know that I was wrong about that. God is not perfect. Now, I woke up after that thought several hours later in a sleeping bag, with my pillow, my head on a pillow, in the bathroom with two sinks. And I had no idea why I went camping in the bathroom when there's eight bedrooms in this house. And it smelled like bleach. And I was sort of put together funny. But I didn't know why I was there. My mouth tasted like charcoal. And I guess that's old tequila. And I got out of I unzipped the sleeping bag, and I looked around, and everybody was gone, and they'd gone to school, and I got on my bike, and I went to school, and halfway to school, I realized what had happened, that I was cool for 20 minutes, and then I was like the most uncool person that could possibly ever be in my group of friends, and that they had to clean up both ends of me and stuff me in a sleeping bag, And I've been to a lot of AA meetings, and I've heard speakers say, you know, I got sick and threw up all over, and I, you know, had all these problems, and I couldn't wait to do it again. But to tell you the truth, that was the longest ride to school. I thought, God, I just don't want to be like my brother. I just can't do that. And you know, a funny thing about that is I've been friends with those guys ever since, and they've never mentioned it. Not one time. One of them asked once if he could hear my CD from a talk, and I gave it to him. And he said, Jesus, Mitch, if we knew that shot of tequila was going to make all hell break loose, we never would have given it to you. Like, he's a nice guy. But about 12 years later, I lived on South Catalina and Avenue Way in an apartment, and I weighed 108 pounds, and I weigh 168 pounds today. And I've been fired from a job that was beneath me. Anybody else? It was like the fourth time that happened, too. It was really weird. And it was one of those guys' weddings. I can't remember which one. I actually was texting them today to try to figure it out because it has to do with the hotels around here. It was one of those guys' weddings, and we were in our 30s. I was 30 years old. And I went to this wedding, and I remember I decided I was going to try not to drink because I hadn't had a sober day for a long time, and I'd lost this job, and I owed everybody money, but I had to go to this wedding because it was one of my five best friends' wedding. And I remember sitting at the table trying not to drink and looking at my date, and I was embarrassed by my date. My date was too young for me. I thought, these are the guys that I grew up with. All of their parents are there. They were like my parents. And it was really clear to me that what was wrong was me, that I was the problem and that I needed to change. And it was so clear. I know everybody in this room can relate to that moment of clarity. I thought, you know, I am going to change. I can't go on like this. I'm looking at this girl, and she's so embarrassing. She's way too young for me. I decide I'm going to break up with her after this wedding, which is going to be super uncomfortable because she's 6 months pregnant. That's going to be a problem. I'm not running for president. I'm speaking at an AA conference, so whatever. All your judgment. Yeah. I felt that. I'm just trying to tell the truth. So I remember thinking, I don't have any money. I don't have any money. All the change has been dug out of my couch. I've pawned my guitars. And one of the things that I wanted to say about my mother is when I was in seventh grade, my mother looked at me and she said, honey, you don't get picked first for the team, do you? And I didn't know how she knew that. But my mother was a school teacher. She said, do you want to play an instrument? And I said, yeah, Mom, I want to play the guitar. And we didn't have any money. And my mom bought me a guitar within an hour. And for 10 years of my life, I was a professional musician because my mother recognized who was in her house. And in spite of the fact that she didn't want me to do that, she knew that it was the right thing for me to do. I did go to college, but I went on the road with a band. I lived on the East Coast and toured for a long time. And that's part of my story. I don't need to say anything else about what it was like other than I drank myself out of a rock and roll band. Yeah. That's really hard to do. But I did it. I'm not a total... I've accomplished some things in my life. Anyway, I was at this wedding. I don't have any money at all. My date's embarrassing me, which just tells you how selfish and self-centered I was. I was 30 years old and she was 18. Okay, whatever. I decided I was going to call my mother because my mother was dying of cancer. And I really love my mother. And I thought if I could just talk to my mom for a second, who I was constantly reminded of by all these people at this wedding and these really good guys I grew up with who had good lives and they had good jobs. And, you know, I was the conquering hero. I was a rock and roll star for a little while. And now I'm this guy who can't keep a job. And this, why did he bring her? And why is he so skinny? And what's wrong with Mitch? You know, and I can see it all and I can feel it all. And I just know for sure this is it. It's done. I don't have to do this anymore. I don't have to sit on my couch and hold my breath when the mailman comes on the porch. I'm going to call my mom. I'm going to borrow a couple $100. I'm going to get my phone turned back on. I'm going to go get a job. I'm going to clean myself up. I'm going to talk to this girl's parents. That's all I need to do. So I got up from the table at this reception, and it was at the hotel right across the street here. And I went into the phone booths. There's a bank of phone booths, and there were two or three things happening. There was this wedding, there was a bar mitzvah, and another wedding. And I went into the phone booth, and I put my head against the glass, and I thought, I just need to tell my mother that I'm in trouble. I need help, and I love her, and I've been keeping secrets, and I'm so ready to change. And I start dialing her number, their number. My parents were married, and I looked down under the phone book, the phone, and there was an envelope. And I pulled the envelope out, and there were four $100 bills in it. And I hung the phone up, and I walked out of that wedding. And I left that girl at that table, and I disappeared for 2 weeks. That's what it was like for me. I didn't want to drink anymore. But all of a sudden, it didn't seem so bad. All of a sudden, maybe I wasn't a complete and utter failure. And I didn't go turn my phone on. And by the time May 16th came along, you know, I had these parents that were loving and kind and a great demonstration of how to be married. My father always called my mother the greatest thing that ever happened to him. And my mother was just this beautiful, quiet, observant, dignified woman. And she taught me through her actions, you treat women with dignity. And by the time I got sober, that poor teenage girl who was pregnant with my child had been emotionally, psychically, and physically abused in every possible way by me. And I didn't grow up like that. But when I drink alcohol, and before I drink alcohol, it's all about me. And I actually pushed her down a flight of stairs when she was 8.5 months pregnant. And I want to tell you, this guy would never do that. I didn't want to hurt her, and I didn't want to hurt that baby. But I didn't feel anything for them. And I wanted to drink that day, and she wanted to go to the doctor. So May 9th was Mother's Day, and my brother, who had been homeless, was sober for about 12 years, I think, at that time. And he called me on May 8th, and he said, hey, it's Mother's Day tomorrow, and we want to make sure you don't miss it. He said, I know you're having car trouble, which I think is so funny and so polite. You know, we're Irish family, and we're very polite. My car trouble was I had the key to a car. I just had no idea where the matching car was. And we don't like to embarrass each other, so I had car trouble. Yeah, and he goes, and I want to make sure you're going to show up. And I remember thinking, why would he think I'm not going to show up, right? Well, it turns out that I'd been calling my mother, who was very ill with cancer, and saying, Mom, I'm going to come visit you today. And I never showed up. Now, I know that when I called my mother, if you had put a gun to my head and said, are you going to go see your mother? I would say, absolutely. As soon as I hang up the phone, I love my mother. I respect my mother. She's one of the most intelligent, kind, loving human beings I've ever met, and I'm her favorite. I'm her youngest. I'm her boy. Of course I'm going to go see my mother. But I also know that when I said that with all earnestness and sincerity, I hung up the phone, and I probably walked by a mirror, and I realized I was a little skinnier than I remembered, and I realized I'd lost another job that was beneath me, and I realized that I couldn't remember whether I told them about Anna's pregnancy or not. Because I lie all the time and I can't remember what I told you. So I probably just thought I'll just drink a beer and then I'll go see my mother. And you know what happens. You hear the birds at 5 o'clock in the morning. So my brother called and said, I want to make sure you're not going to miss it. And I'm going to come pick you up tomorrow and take you down to King Harbor Yacht Club. Was having a brunch for Mother's Day. And my plan was I'll take a shower, I'll get some clean clothes on, I'll get a card, I'll get some flowers, and I'll go to Mother's Day. What happened was I stayed up all night drinking, and my brother honked his horn. And I turned around and looked out the window. I couldn't believe he was there. I felt like I just talked to him. And I'm dirty, and I smell bad. And I went out there, and my brother looked at me, and he was a little startled. And I didn't know why. No one had seen me for months. I didn't know why he was startled. I didn't realize he could see my skull. And I got in his car, and I ruined Mother's Day. The way it was put to me is, you should really come because it's probably Mom's last Mother's Day. And I ruined it. I can't really tell you what I did. I just remember how they all looked at me. And I remember being asked to leave early. My sister and I are very close. And she told me a few years ago, she said, yeah, you were vulgar in front of Mom. And we didn't know why. We didn't know why you were saying the things you were saying. So I don't know what happened exactly. But I remember they all looked at me and I felt smaller and more insignificant than I'd ever felt because all the people that were supposed to love me no matter what suddenly shut off. Now, I've had many, many moments of bitter and incomprehensible demoralization because of alcoholism. I've done things to people that I can't still believe that I did to people. I've already mentioned a couple of them to you. And I've let things be done to me that I never thought I'd let be done to me. But that moment at that table in Redondo Beach with my family was the worst one. And I don't know why. If you saw the movie, you'd say that wasn't the worst one. But I was in the movie. And I never felt worse than I did on that moment. And my brother took me home and we got in a fight about something. I don't know what. We don't remember. And he threw me out of his car. He was really mad at me. And I went into my apartment. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to lose this fight. I'm sick of being the youngest in this family. I'm sick of him always talking down to me. And I love this, right? I've been sitting on my couch for 6 months. I got a girl across town pregnant with my child. I can't get a job. I'm lying to everybody. I owe thousands of dollars to people. The police are looking for me and drug dealers are looking for me. And I feel I have the moral higher ground in this argument with my sober 12-year brother. My brother is so obnoxious, and his ex-wife is in the crowd tonight. She'll love this. He bought a house with 12 steps to his front door. Kind of hard to take sometimes. But I wasn't going to let him. He didn't have that house then. He lived in Lawndale. I wasn't going to let him win. So I called him up and I just started screaming at him. I gave him the half hour it took to drive home and I'm just letting him have it. And I'm telling him everything about how right I am, whatever it was. And there's this thing that I was told about in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's called grace. And I was told by Jay, my grand sponsor who's here tonight, that grace is an unwarranted gift. That grace is just a gift that you get that you don't necessarily deserve, that you didn't necessarily earn. It's just the way the universe works, you get this gift. And I was about to have a moment of grace, and I didn't even know it. And I screamed and screamed and yelled at my brother. And when I ran out of steam, I was quiet for a minute. And my brother was quiet. And then he said very calmly into the phone, Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. That was not the grace. I had had that put to me before by many people, people that made money because of my talent. I was, you know, dating this girl and I met her parents and the dad took me for a walk and kind of told me what he thought of me. And it was about I was an alcoholic and my brother's telling me this. That's not grace. In fact, my brother kind of scared me at that time in general. And he said, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. What's grace is what happened next. And I don't know if any of you have had this experience. I've actually had it sponsoring people, but this was the first time I can remember having this experience. The words that came out of my mouth in answer to that statement, I didn't know I was about to say. I didn't plan on saying them. They just came out of my mouth. I kind of look at it like God hit me between the shoulder blades and the truth stumbled out of my mouth. But my brother said, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. And I said, of course I do. And I was a little surprised. And now I know I worked the first step. I admitted it. I love it. I think these are 12 surrenders, and I love that the second word is admitted. That's a surrender. I'd known. I'd been trying not to drink every day of that pregnancy. I'd been trying not to drink every day of that unemployment. I'd wake up and go, get a job today. Go see Anna's parents today. Go see your mom today. Clean up this apartment today. Don't drink today. And that was always the problem. I didn't realize what I realize now. I might as well have said, hold back the Pacific Ocean today. Because I was always on something. So I said, of course I do. And then my brother said the funniest thing. He said, don't go anywhere. And I go, oh, okay, I was going to move to that end of the couch in October. But if you think I shouldn't go anywhere, you know, I'll just sit right here. You know, like I hadn't gone anywhere in months. And then this beautiful thing happened. I lived 25, 30 minutes away, and my brother was standing in the doorway in 10 minutes. And you guys know why, if you work with others. Because my brother heard something in my voice that's a very rare and valuable thing in recovery, and it's called willingness. And he heard it, and he loved me. And he raced to me. Now, my brother had a way of teaching me lessons when I was a kid that involved him punching me. Sometimes more than once. So I thought, my brother's going to come over here, he's going to kick my ass, and I'm never going to drink alcohol again. I did, that was sort of what I was expecting, and I kind of was hoping it was true. Because I've only been able to tell you a tiny little bit about what it was like. I told you what it was like on the outside. And just a little bit. What it was like inside of me was awful and disgusting and filthy, and I couldn't stand it. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if he just came here and knocked me out? And he didn't. My brother's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He certainly was on that day. And he showed up to my apartment, and he said, let's go down to the beach. And we walked out the apartment, and we walked down to the beach on the lifeguard stand at Avenue A. I actually have a painting of that lifeguard stand because it means so much to me. And he sat across from me, and I started fumbling with a pack of cigarettes, and I started lighting cigarettes and waiting for him to start screaming at me. And he looked at me for a long time, and then he started talking to me about how he felt when my mother and my father threw him out of our house when he was 17 years old. And I was so surprised he said that because I was 10, and I really wanted to know what was going on with him. And he just started telling me about it. And then he started talking to me about how he felt when his wife and son threw them out of their house. I know what that was. I know I was about 15, 14, 15. I remember that day because he called me. He called me and talked to me because he had nobody left. He called his little brother. And I remember he was crying into the phone. He said, I lost my marriage. I lost my family. I can't believe it. But I remember what I said to him. I said, maybe you should stop drinking. And I remember what he said to me. He said, you don't understand. And he was right, because I hadn't had a shot of tequila yet. And then he started talking to me about how he felt when he lived in his car. And I remember when he lived in his car, because I used to drive around and look for his car when I was 16, 17 years old. And if he was in it, I'd look in the window, and if he breathed, I left. If he wasn't in it, I left a note, I love you. And right in the middle of this, my brother's talking to me about how he felt in those situations. And my brother is describing exactly how I feel sitting on that lifeguard stand. And I didn't think anybody in the world knew how I felt. And I know now that my brother was a student of the Big Book, because the Big Book in the chapter Working with Others says, tell them a little bit of your own story and win their confidence. And he did exactly that. And I am so grateful, because I go to Alcoholics Anonymous conferences all over the world. I've been to thousands and thousands of AA meetings. And occasionally I'll hear somebody get up and say, my sponsor thumped me on the chest and called me stupid. And I'm here to say, I've read that book many, many times. And nowhere in that book does it say to do that. In fact, it says never, ever to do that. It says never talk down to an alcoholic. I don't think it says that in the Al-Anon literature, but it says that in the Alcoholics Anonymous literature. I don't know. I didn't read that book. It says patience and tolerance. It says it over and over again. And, you know, thank God my brother didn't do what was my big brother that day. My brother was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was a guy dying of alcoholism, and he acted accordingly. And my brother, I actually only surrendered because I ran out of cigarettes. I was like, crap, he's still talking. And I'm out of cigarettes. So I said, you know, you're right, man. I got to go to AA. And then this wise Buddha disappeared. And my sarcastic older brother reappeared. And he looked at me and goes, AA, you're not going to AA, dude. You're going to a hospital. And I remember I looked at him and I said, yeah, I can't really do that. I'm busy. And then he said, I go, how long do I have to go to a hospital? He goes, I don't know, it's like 30 days. I go, yeah, I really can't leave all this. I've been sitting on my couch for 6 months. And I joke about it, but I always say, you know, like, what was I thinking? You're like, who's not going to pay my bills? I'm the guy not paying my bills right now. Yeah. Who's not going to answer that phone? That's my job. I don't answer that phone. All the balls will fall if you take me out of the equation. Like, what the heck? But he ignored that I was busy. And he walked me up to my porch, and I remember he looked at me and he said, "Don't die." And I remember thinking, he knows about the gun that I put in my mouth at night. Because I wasn't going to be a dad like this. And I knew I was a bad son. And I knew I couldn't get a job. And I knew I'd ruined my musical career. And I knew that nobody on earth really cared about me anymore. So sometimes at night, I would take my roommate had a... He wasn't there. He'd moved to Mexico, but he sublet the apartment. And he had a gun, and he had hollow point bullets. And I'd put the bullets in the gun, and I'd stand in front of the window with it popped up against the roof of my mouth, and I'd pray for courage. And I'll tell you something about recovery. When I moved out of that apartment, I took one of those hollow point bullets and I put it in a little silk purse and I kept it in my pocket. And I used to take it to meetings with me and I'd touch it occasionally. And remember, that's how bad it was. And then one day I looked at it and the bullet said, "This is what a self-centered little puke you became." And I threw that frickin' bullet away. How bad it got. I was about to do the ultimate selfish act. My mother was dying of cancer. And I was about to shoot myself in the head. My daughter wasn't even born, and she was going to be born and find out her dad shot himself before she was born. It was just selfishness. It was just more selfishness. So my brother said, "Hang tight. I'm going to get you into a hospital." And about 5 days later, he said, "We got you into hospital. We're going to pick you up tomorrow." So I ran out and got ready for rehab. I started drinking a lot and more. And I sold my last guitar, and I was doing things that I thought would maybe take care of this business so I didn't have to go. And apparently I passed out on the floor. I passed out on a big gulp. And I don't know where that came from, because 7-Eleven was many miles from my house. But I woke up, and I was sticky. And I had OR scrubs on and a T-shirt with a hole in it. And I remember all this because I had to go do something that I didn't expect. The phone rang, and I thought it was my brother, so I answered it. And it was a woman who said, "We've been trying to reach you. Your daughter was born today. Can you come to the hospital?" And I jumped up and thought, why am I so sticky? You know, and I put on my flip-flops and I grabbed my car key and I headed off into Redondo Beach. And I ran around looking for my car. And grace happened. I found it. And there were a bunch of parking tickets in the windshield. And any of you who live in Redondo Beach, that's a miracle too. It should have been booted or towed away, right? I threw him in the back seat. Another thing of grace happened. I turned the key and it started. And I hadn't seen that car for months. But then Matthew intervened in the grace. And, you know, you all have heard beautifully, I want to say the speakers, right? Carrie was fantastic today and Laura last night. And they talked so much about selfishness and self-centeredness and alcoholism and codependence. And I was so self-centered that I started my car up and I drove directly to the hospital where I was born. Because that's where babies come from. They weren't there. And I'm yelling at this lady. I weigh 108 pounds. I'm wearing completely inappropriate clothes. I'm not a doctor. I just have surgical scrubs on. And she's going, "You can yell at me all you want. They're not here." And I went out and I put my head on my steering wheel and I started crying. And I thought, man, you can't even do this. You should just go home and shoot yourself. And then grace happened. I started the car and the name of the hospital appeared in my head. And I went to the hospital and I ran upstairs to see her, to see this baby. And I wasn't really prepared. I wasn't really thinking about it. I was just going. And I ran down. I'm looking at all the rooms. I'm trying to find the room. I don't know why they number hospital rooms the way they do, but I have 2 degrees and I couldn't find this room. I'm looking around and it's keeping me busy. And my sponsor, Bill, calls it lizard brain. I had to do the next thing and the next thing. Just do the next thing, just next thing. I'm not thinking about what it is or why I might be doing it. I'm just doing it. And I run into the room and there's Anna. And she's glad to see me. And last time I saw her, she had a look of terror on her face because I was abusing her. And she was happy to see me, which made me feel weird. And I don't know if anybody's ever seen a woman that just had a baby, but they look kind of like the Elephant Man. You know, they have like this jowly thing going on and their hairs matted to their head, and I am not an animal. And look, I'm not running for president. I'm telling you what I saw at the hospital. And that's how she looked. And she got up and she started coming towards me. And I can honestly tell you, to this very day, she has never been more beautiful than she was right then. And I got to be honest with you, I didn't even like her. But she was so beautiful. And she just comes towards me. She's so happy. And she's so glad to see me. And I just feel filthy and disgusting. But then something happened. And she reached into this plexiglass box and she pulled out an angel of God named Phoebe Rose. And she put Phoebe into my arms. And I would love to tell you that I felt love for her. I would love to tell you that I felt a connection to them. But I didn't. I felt so disgusting. All of that ugliness on the inside, I felt like it was coming out of my pores. I felt evil. I felt untrustworthy. I felt like a beast, and they were beautiful and innocent. Don't get me wrong. I could see how beautiful Phoebe was. I'm an artist. I can see beauty. I could see how beautiful Anna was. I just didn't fit in that picture. And I wanted to go home and shoot myself. That's all I wanted to do. And I lied. The first thing I said in front of my daughter was a lie. I said to Anna, everything's going to be all right. And I had planned on making sure they never saw me again. In fact, I ran down the stairs of that hospital. I'd been in that room for 2 minutes. And I ran down that stairs and I said to myself, God, please make it so these two people never see me again. Because I'm going to do something stupid and they're going to get really hurt, because that's what I do all the time to everyone. And I got back to my house and my brother was sitting on my porch and he said, where have you been? And I said, my daughter was born today. And he didn't say, what's her name? Is she healthy? He said, get in the car. I packed your stuff. And we got in the car and we drove off to a hospital. Scariest day of my life was the day I got let loose into that hospital. I walked in there. I don't know those people. I don't have my medicine. Anybody want to guess what the second scariest day was? Coming out. 30 days later, I gained 47 pounds in the hospital. They weigh you on the way in. When the guy went, whoa, he did. The guy who weighs drug addicts for a living weighed me and went, wow. And I said, what? He's like, nothing. And then he wrote 108. And then on the way out, he did the same thing. He said, you gained 47 pounds in 30 days. And I went back to my apartment with my brother, and my brother's an obnoxious Alcoholics Anonymous member, and he drops me off in front of my apartment, and he says, go to a meeting today. And I thought, these AA guys, they're so intense. And I remember I lied, and I said, yeah, that's what I was going to do. And I can guarantee you, I'm not going to an AA meeting. I just had 30 days. I'm going to go see my mother. I'm going to go see my daughter. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to, you know, try to figure out how to get out of all this trouble. I got stuff to do. I'm on fire. I'm never getting loaded again. I got 30 days in the hospital. And I walk up on my porch and I open my door and somebody hands me a beer. Actually, it wasn't a beer. It was a Coors. I don't know what you call that in America, but I looked at that beer and I backed up and I put it on my porch and I ran away from my own house. Now, how many people are in their first year of sobriety here? Okay, just a few. I want to tell you exactly why I did that. I didn't do that because I had a program of recovery and a foundation and a connection to a higher power. I didn't. I did that for one reason, and I hope you really hear me when I say this. I did that because I looked at all those people in my apartment. I looked at the cocaine on the glass table. I smelled the pot smoke in the air. I looked at that beer, and I thought, all you have in the world, Matthew, is 30 days of recovery. You got nothing else. Do you really want to throw it away on these people one more time? And I got to tell you, I loved having 30 days. I could think. I could breathe in and out, and I could tell what things felt like. And when people talked to me, I said appropriate things back to them. sometimes. And well, I had a lot to learn. I mean, I thought they were appropriate, but they, and I put that down and I ran. I just ran away and I ran to a phone booth. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I went to an AA meeting. Turns out I didn't lie. And that's really what I came to tell you about. I can't tell you about all the things that happened to me here, but I can tell you about some really important ones. One of the things that happened is that night at that AA meeting, I sat through the whole thing. I didn't understand a word. The speaker got up and he did this. He got up and he held the podium. He had a suit on. It was Stompers. Remember Stompers? Yeah. And he went, wah, 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 wah. Wah, 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 wah. And I'm like, uh-oh. And everybody's laughing and nudging each other and they're all digging it. And I'm like, I'm screwed, you know. And then I got up to leave and I'm walking out and one of my brother's friends, coffee shop Jim, said, hey, aren't you Neil's little brother? And I said, yeah. And he said, I heard you look like crap. So he said, attraction rather than promotion. And I said, well, that was 30 days ago. I've done a lot of work on myself since then. And he said, can I give you a ride home? And I said, that'd be great, because I ran here. And he didn't understand that. And we're walking out to his car, and I'm slowing down. And we're walking out, and I'm slowing down. And he finally goes, what's your problem? And I go, well, I can't really go home. And he said, why not? And I told him about the Coors and the cocaine and the pot and the girls and my apartment. And he said, yeah, you can't go there. And he said, don't your parents live near here? And I said, yeah, they live right over the hill near West High. And he said, well, we can go there. And I said, no, man, we can't go there. Now, for all of you that raised your hand in your first year of sobriety, and actually it took me about 10 years of sobriety to learn this lesson, but I had a perception of what that was going to be like, going to my parents' house. And part of it was altruistic that I didn't want to go there, and part of it was very self-centered. But the altruistic part was, hey, those people have been married to each other for 45 years. They're madly in love with each other. My mother's dying of cancer right in front of my father's eyes. Their loser son, fresh out of rehab with an illegitimate child across town, is not showing up on their porch tonight and embarrassing them again. It would be the worst possible thing that could happen to them. It would be the most humiliating possible thing that could happen to me. I can't go to my parents' house because I know exactly what that's going to be like. So Jim dropped me off at my parents' house. Because it turns out you don't really listen to newcomers. And he knew where my parents were because my brother belonged to the Treasures. And that was a really good AA group. And they took care of my parents. And they helped my parents out. They painted the flagpole. They did good stuff for them, right? So he knew where my parents lived. He dropped me off and he let me go and he drove away. And I walked up to the porch and I remember thinking, I can't go in here. And I knocked at the door and my parents are from Illinois. They're from the Midwest and they answered the door together. So it takes a while now. My mom's really sick. So I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And I just feel like I need to disappear. I need to get away from here. I can't stand here. And the door opens and there's my mother and my father. And they were glad to see me. Really glad. It escaped out of their eyes. Remember my perception? Reality was those people were married to each other for 45 years. They're madly in love with each other. And the kid they've been laying awake at night praying for, worrying about, just showed up at their doorstep looking pretty good. And he said some magic words to them. He said, can you help me? It was perfect. It couldn't have been more perfect. I just didn't know that. So they took me in and I moved into my old bedroom at 31 years old. Pretty cool. And I just want to say, perception is always wrong. It's based on the past and projecting into the future. Reality is always perfect. It's never not perfect. It's sometimes uncomfortable, but it's never not perfect. And I went into that bedroom and I had a life-size poster of Eric Clapton I put up on my wall when I was 12. And I said, I'm back, Eric. A lot has happened. And he was so cool my first year of sobriety. He's super quiet, but really wise. remember I woke up in the morning and I said, Dad, I think there's a meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning. It says this attitude adjustment. Can I borrow the car? And what I was really saying is, I'm so uncomfortable here, I have to get the hell out of here. And he said, if you're going to an AA meeting, you don't have to ask. And I got in the car and I drove directly to the attitude adjustment meeting because I'm not safe anywhere else in the South Bay at that time. Bad things are going to happen if I don't go right there. And I thought, I got out of the uncomfortable place. That's so great. And then I came to the other uncomfortable place. You people. And I came in and everyone's Charlie Brown's teacher and everyone's happy. And as soon as the hour was up, I jump in the car and I drive back to the uncomfortable place. So that was my first year of sobriety. I went to 3 meetings a day for all the wrong reasons. And amazing things happened to me. One of the things that happened to me is I went to the Tuesday night surf and sand step study men's stag meeting. Rich Metcalf was there. Stevie was there. I walked in there. It was my first Tuesday night meeting. And I went up to the coffee because I don't know about you guys, but when I was new, everybody in AA was staring at me and talking about me. Did that happen to anybody else? It's really weird. But I have something to tell you. You guys actually have landed in the epicenter of self-centered thinking. No one's staring at you, and no one's thinking about you. They're resting their eyes on you while they think about themselves. Be free, my children. Your perception is wrong. But I remember I was watching them stare at me and talk about me, and I was filling up the coffee, and I filled it up too high, and it was only held in there by surface tension. Carrie's a scientist. She understands what I'm talking about. And the only chair is all the way across the room. Remember that chair when you're new? It's like got a spotlight on it and it's empty. So I go across the room. I start burning my hand as soon as I start walking. I'm like, it's fine. It's totally okay. It's fine. It's totally good. It's fine. So now they actually are staring at me and talking about me. And I sit down and I remember, I think it was Steve E. He said, please don't share at this meeting if you haven't worked the step. And I went right on. And I just stared at my hand. And the hour was up, and I got up, and I ran out, and I went home to my parents. 3 meetings, 3 meetings, 3 meetings, 3 meetings, 3 meetings. 7 days later, I'm at the Tuesday night step study. I walk in there. I walk up to the coffee pot. I fill up that coffee halfway. College. And I go over to the seat that's still got a spotlight on it, and I turn around, and something magical happened. I turn around, and everybody was there the week before was there again. Remember that? And they looked happy, and they had a different set of clothes on. I didn't. They had shoes that looked nice, and I noticed that. They weren't hiding in this meeting. They went there because they wanted to go. And I went a couple more weeks, and I got back there every Tuesday night. And I remember one Tuesday night, I don't know what we were talking about. Maybe it was the 5th step. I don't know. Maybe it was the 9th step. But some guy shared this really embarrassing story. And I perked up a little. I thought, cool, we'll all make fun of this guy. Finally, this will get fun, you know. This guy shared, I can't believe he shared that, right? And then I waited for somebody to jump on him. And the next guy raised his hand and said, yeah, I did that, but I was wearing women's underwear when I did that. I was like, no, man, that's not how this is supposed to go. And then it happened again. And then it happened again. And I witnessed spiritual love. And I got cleaner. And all I did was sit there. I went home cleaner. And I didn't say a word. My feet were really good at AA. And that's all that really mattered. And I remember I got a sponsor at that meeting. And I went up to him. I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, do you have a job? And I remember thinking, you know, I was taught that it's rude to answer a question with a question. And I said, no, I don't have a job. And he said, well, you should get a job. And I said, well, what kind of job should I get? And he said, the kind with a paycheck. I remember thinking, it's just so simple here. And I went and got a job stacking newspapers at night from midnight to 4 a.m. at the Daily Breeze. I had 2 degrees. And that job was not beneath me. I'd smoke cigarettes on my break and say the Serenity Prayer. And then I go do my job. I go home and sleep for a couple hours. I go to this attitude adjustment meeting that I delivered packages for my brother's company from till noon. I go to another meeting. That's what I did. And you know, I told you, you know, my parents, I moved in with my parents and it couldn't have been worse and it was so embarrassing. I really got a chance to watch my parents love each other. I got a chance to hold my father at night when he cried about losing my mom. My father was a mighty person in my mind. My father has a Bronze Star from World War II. My father is a hero. He's seen things that I can only imagine. And yet me, the kid that wasn't supposed to be there, was holding him while he cried from his gut. And I remember one of the important things I always try to talk about when I come here is something really important. I went up to my sponsor when I was like 90 days sober and I said, you know, I thought it was the worst thing in the world having Phoebe. I didn't think I could love this little girl and have this child with this girl that I don't get along with. But it turns out it's the best thing because I love Phoebe. I got 90 days. I love Phoebe more than I love myself. And my sponsor just walked right by me into the meeting. I remember thinking, I did not know he was deaf in his left ear, you know. So I looked at him across the room waiting for a reassuring smile, you know, and it did not come. And then we got up to leave and he walked by me and I go, he used to give me a ride to meetings. And I go, hey, maybe you don't understand because you don't have kids. And he goes, hey, just stop it. I said, what? And he goes, how much child support do you pay? I said, well, you know, I work at a newspaper at night and I live with my mom and my dad. And he said, no, that's your circumstances. I asked you, how much child support do you pay? And I said, well, I don't pay any. And he goes, then you're kind of full of it. He said, I got an idea. Why don't you show me that you love your daughter, and then you'll never have to tell me again. We had a really quiet drive home. I was planning his death, and he was living in the present moment. And I got home, I started telling Eric I had to get a new sponsor. And then it dawned on me, my face was red and I was humiliated because he was right. And I called up Anna and I said, you know, I should give you some money. And she said, oh, that would be so great. This is so hard. And I said, well, I don't make that much money. And I was going to give her an amount. And she goes, oh, no, let's not do it that way. Let's do a percentage. Super smart girl. She was betting on my horse, right? So every 2 weeks I paid that money because I didn't have a bank account. I had to go cash my check. And every 2 weeks I paid that money, every 2 weeks. And after a year, I was playing with Phoebe. And she's so beautiful. She has a giant Irish head. She's doomed, you know. She's 100% Irish. And I'm playing with her and she's banging her head on me and she's grabbing my jaw. And Phoebe, I love Phoebe because she didn't have an agenda for me. She accepted me. You know, we spent a lot of good time together my first year of sobriety because I paid that money. And I'm playing with her and playing with her. And I said, Phoebe, I'm going to be your dad for the rest of your life. I'm going to take you to your first day of kindergarten. I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. I'm going to buy you a car when you're 16, baby. I'm going to send you to college. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm your dad. Isn't that great? And she thought it was great. She didn't change expressions at all. The world goes on. She's perfectly at peace. And a year before that, I prayed a righteous prayer. God, please make it so these two women never see me again. And you guys got a hold of me. And my feet took me to meetings. And you said, just do this. We don't care what you think. Just do this. And I did it. I got a sponsor. I did a four step. I did a fifth step. I paid all the money back. It took me years and years and years. I remember I went to my sponsor and I said, I owe this guy $10,000. I can't pay him back. And he said, or I owed him $15,000. I can't pay him back. And he goes, why not? And I go, well, I don't have $15,000. And he says, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to walk up with a suitcase full of money? And I go, well, how do I do it? And he goes, well, where does he live? I said, he lives in Mexico City. And he goes, well, how much could you give him if you could give it to him today? I said, I can give him $20. And he said, okay, write him a letter, send him $20. I go, I owe him $15,000. And he said, just start. And I did. I did it every month. Sometimes he'd come up and go, how much did you send Larry today? I go, I didn't send him any. He goes, well, you got to keep doing it. And then I got better jobs, and I sent him $100 sometimes and $200, and sometimes I'd forget. But I kept really clear track in a little book. Because when I'm ripping you off, I'm kind of vague about it. But when I'm paying you back, I'm super, super clear. It turns out. Anyway, after 7 years, I paid him $7,000. And I said, he called me up and he said, I think it was 7 years, might have been a little less than that. And he said, hey, stop paying me this money. And I said, what are you talking about? And he goes, I don't know what you're doing, man, but you've become the guy I've always wanted you to be. You're a good husband. You're a good father. You were a good son. You're a great guy. I always knew this guy was in you. You've already paid me back. Yeah. And I made the mistake of calling my sponsor. This is a cautionary tale. And I said, hey, I'm done. I don't have to pay Larry back anymore. And he said, really? Why not? And I told him. And then he said, wow, that's that guy you paid $20 a month when you live with your mom and your dad. You paid that guy $20 a month. Remember that? And you live with your mom and your dad. He goes, now you've got this amazing life. He goes, hey, man, you want to stop doing what's working? That's awesome. It's $8,000 call to my sponsor. My mother died in my arms. And I was so clean with her. And my father followed her a year later, right in front of me. And he left me some money. And I said, hey, I know what to do with this. And I wrote a check for $8,000. And I FedExed it to Larry. And I swear to God, this happened. Larry called me up and he said, you're not going to believe this. He said, I was looking at my wife a few minutes ago. We've been talking about how we found out she's pregnant last night. We're thinking about how we're going to buy this house we've been renting in Newport Beach. And we looked at our money and we were about $8,000 short of a down payment. And your check came. Grace, 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 grace. Right? So the loser, the flake, the animal, got to help this really good guy buy a house with his own money, you know. That's a little bit of the story I'd like to leave that out, actually. But Bill says I can't. Kind of sours, it makes it not so good. I'm going to go a little bit over, is that okay? So I got a good job, and I was heading to the airport one day. I got a job at the airlines, at Qantas Airlines. And I was heading to the airport one day, and I bought a guitar. I was still living with my mom and my dad, and I bought a guitar at Guitar Center's beautiful guitar. And I got to work, and I kept visiting it at breaks, you know. And I picked up my guitar at 10 o'clock, and I ran out to the employee bus and went up to the employee bus stop. And I realized I'm about to go home to my mom and dad. No one's going to share in my joy about this guitar. So I turned to the first person I see waiting at the bus stop. And it's this woman from British Airways. And I said, hey, can I show you this guitar I just bought? And she looked at me and she said, I don't look at strange men's guitars. All of a sudden, she's Irish. I think she was actually British. And I thought, wow, that's weird. I'm not hitting on you. I actually just want you to look at my guitar. But she didn't want to. And we got on the bus. And we were pressed up against each other. And she was uncomfortable because the bus was so crowded. And she had a book in her hand called Surprised by Joy. And I said, oh, I've read that book. It's by C.S. Lewis. And she said, well, cut to the chase. Do you believe in God? And I think I spit on her a little when I said, God saved my life. And all the blood rushed out of her face. And now she really didn't want to look at my guitar. And I thought, God, Matthew, chill out, you know. And I said, well, what about you? And she goes, well, I don't think so. And she started talking about it, and we started talking. And I said, well, no, you know, I don't believe in that God. I don't believe in the God you don't believe in either, you know. I mean, we were talking about God. And I realized while we were talking about God that she was really, really beautiful. I didn't care before. I wanted two eyes to look at my guitar. But it turns out these eyes were blue, and they were surrounded by this really pale, beautiful skin. It turns out she was Welsh, and she's petite and gorgeous. She had these great cheekbones. And I was comfortable and relaxed. So all the men in the room know that's called a spiritual awakening. I didn't start lying that I was an astronaut in my spare time or a brain surgeon. I just talked about God with this gorgeous woman, and I felt totally comfortable in my own skin. We got off the bus, and I said, hey, do you think maybe you would want to go out to dinner with me sometime, you know, we don't have to even talk about this guitar. And she did not think so. She was like, oh, right, look at my guitar. I read that book. You believe in God? So I go, hey, And it was said earlier, but I said to her, I said, no is a complete sentence. And she leaned back a little, and she went to her car, and I went to my car, and I just felt sad, you know. I felt like I blew it. She felt like home in 5 minutes, 10 minutes on that bus. I drove home, and I told my father about it. And my father said, I don't think that's over. And my father used to say stuff like that just to get me to stop talking. So I was, oh, okay, Dad. And I remember I felt like I grew spiritually because I went to work the next day and I didn't tell anyone she was a lesbian, right? It's nobody's business, right? I'm okay. You're okay. You just don't like me. You couldn't have rejected me. You rejected my whole gender, right? Because that's how I used to think. But what I thought was, that's too bad. I really liked her. And I didn't think about her at all. I thought about her like 100 times, maybe, not hardly at all that day. And I ran to make the early bus. And she ran up behind me and she said, I think I might have been rude to you last night. She said, I don't want to go out with you. I said, you were super clear about that. And she said, but I'll have coffee with you if you want to miss this bus. And I said, that'd be great. And this is absolutely true. 2.5 weeks later, she proposed to me, and we've been married for 21 years. And that was 100% grace. And you know what? We had 2 children of our own, and they came. I was in the car with her and took her to the appropriate hospital twice. And you know who was there both times? Anna and Phoebe. And you know what I did? I took Phoebe to her first day of kindergarten. You know what I did after that? I took her to her first day of first grade, and I cried like a little baby. I bought her a car when she was 16, and she totaled it like a week after that, and no more cars for Phoebe. And you know what I'm doing right now? I'm putting her through nursing school. That happens here. You know, Philippa and I have an amazing life. We both worked for airlines at the time. We went all over the world. We had these 2 gorgeous children. But I want to be really clear. You know, people come up here to these podiums and they lie. People come up to you in AA meetings and they lie. Has anybody ever walked up to you as a newcomer and said, everything is going to be all right? Ever figure out that that was a lie? Yeah. It's a lie. Things are going to be what things are going to be, right? And when Philip and I were married for 5 years, I found her on the floor and she had a massive stroke and everything changed forever that day. She became paralyzed on her left side and she became unemployable. She's beautiful and charming, but you can't rely on her. You can't count on her. And we are still very much in love. I'm not a perfect husband, but I love that woman. And sometimes I get lost in my perception. And my perception is, why can't things be like they used to? And is my life going to always be like this? But that's the past, and that's projecting into the future. And Philippa has a very beautiful way of pulling me into the present moment. And I've never once thought it was a mistake to marry Philippa. And I don't think she should be any different than she is. In fact, I'm going to tell you 5 more minutes and I'm going to shut up. About 3 years ago, we got transferred away from here for my job. I now have a very good job. I run 3 states for a biotech company. And I was asked to move to Seattle. And Philippa said that would be a grand adventure. That's what my disabled wife says when you say, do you want to go do something completely crazy and difficult with 2 teenagers in our house? And she says, yes, let's go. And we go up to there, and I thought I was going to lose my mind. I had 2 teenagers yell at me every day that I'd ruined their lives. And my son's 6'3", and he's super articulate. I remember once he yelled at me, you're a corporate whore. And I said, man, I played lead guitar on the stage at CBGB's. I am not a corporate whore. That one hurt. But you know what saved me? You know what saved me? We bought a big piece of property, 5 acres, and I went out in the very end of that property and I built a cabin. to do the 11 step in every single day. And some of my boys on my 11 step group are here. We call each other at 5:30 in the morning and I'm out in that cabin. If it's freezing cold or hotter than heck, I'm sitting in that cabin at 5:30 in the morning and we meditate for 30 minutes every day. And I can tell you, I would not have survived moving to Seattle if I hadn't done that. I woke up every day with an elephant on my chest. What have I done? Why did I move my wife out into the country? Why did I take her away from the city? Why are my children are right? I should have quit my job. I should have looked for something different. I don't have to do this. I felt so dark. But then I go out in that cabin and I meditate for 30 minutes and I float back. I make my wife a cup of coffee. I wake my kids up. I take them to school. The other thing I did right when I moved up there is I couldn't connect with AA. I went to meetings. Nobody runs up to welcome the new guy with 20 years. And I'm going to meetings and they're not doing it right. And I went on one of these conferences and a guy like said, I was supposed to take you to the speaker breakfast, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take you to a Salvation Army. And I said, whatever. And went to the Salvation Army and I was working with these guys. And I thought, this is what I'm not doing in Washington. And I went home and I took a prison panel and a jail panel and it changed everything. I go into the prisons and I go into the jails every month. And I am connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. I see things happen in there that are amazing. There are people in the prisons that are working better programs than anybody I've ever seen outside. It's amazing what happens in there. And I'll finish with this. Sophie made a friend when we first moved there. Her name was Abby, and Abby is a beautiful girl. And Philippa is very sensitive and listens very patiently. She's a lot like my mother. I invite Freud into my relationships, but there are a lot of similarities. And she said to me, you know, this Abby girl, she's in a bad situation. We got to do something. This is 2.5 years ago. And I said, well, you can't just take somebody's kid. And I also thought privately, I've got Sophie, my youngest, almost through the goalposts. And my goalposts, personally, are 18 without being pregnant or addicted to drugs. We're good, right? And Sophie's 16. She's a great kid. Rory's doing great. Phoebe's in nursing school. And she says, I'm telling you, we got to do something. She's in a bad way. And we started finding out about what was happening. And I'll just tell you, in May, I became Abby's dad. She lives with us now, and I have complete parental control out of Abby, and Philippa is her mother. And I walked into the kitchen one day, and Abby was sitting in the kitchen. I go, what's going on, baby? She's sitting in the dark, and she said, I don't know what it's like to live in a positive environment. I don't know how to act. And I thought, you think this is a positive environment? Good for you, girl. You know, I failed. I didn't tell you what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really like my own company. I really work this thing. I have some secrets, but my sponsor knows them. He knows everything about me. I've never stopped being of service in 24 years of sobriety. I get lost in perception and I call somebody or somebody calls me and I get in reality. Or Philippa says, I want to come with you to the South Bay Roundup and I get to enjoy her away from all our responsibilities and I'm in reality. You know, there's something they tell you, everything's going to be all right. And they don't mean everything's going to be all right. What they mean when they say that to you, it's the best intentions. They mean, hey, man, I know you're scared and sick and you feel disgusting. But if you do these 12 steps, no matter what happens to you in your life, you are going to be all right. And I am living proof of that. Thank you for letting me share.